Ladies and gentlemen, forgive me. We're just waiting a second. Senator Dodd is on his way, but I think we may begin just so that I do. Have we heard from Senator Dodd? Oh, he's on his way. Let me just say what I have to say is not important, so I can do this and not take anything away, I think, from the conference or from Senator Dodd being with us. My name is John Hamry, and we have seats up here at the front. Please do come up. I'm the president at CSIS, and I'm delighted to be here. I have the only role today is really to introduce our co-chairs, but I did want to just take a moment to say how grateful I am for their leadership. Felix Roten really was the architect who initiated this with us and suggested that this is a timely subject. I must confess, when he raised it a year and a half ago, it didn't sound that timely. But there's nothing like Hurricane Katrina to kind of change people's attitudes about what we should be thinking about critical infrastructure. Senator Warren Rudman, who became the co-chair with us, and I can't say the number of things that I have asked Senator Rudman to do, and he's always been so willing to do it on top of an enormously busy calendar. And I thank you so much, Senator, for today and for everything that you've done. My only regret is that we don't still have you in the Senate, but I don't think you regret that much. I'll say that before Senator Dodd gets here, I think. Bernard Schwartz is, of course, a member of our commission and CEO of Loral, and has been such a strong and powerful figure in the policy community in Washington. He announced recently he's going to be retiring, and he told me, he says, that's bad news for you because I'm going to spend a lot more time in Washington. And I said, no, that's good news, and I'm delighted for that. Thank you. John Castellani with the Business Roundtable. He's here really taking a break from a titanic battle he's fighting up on Capitol Hill. I know John and his work. Please do come in. We've got seats in the front. And I know John, and he's been really on the forefront of trying to make sure that – no, these are okay. Please do. That the work that we do in the Congress does meet the test of being practical and pragmatic for America's economy and society. John, and so thank you for joining us today and for this effort. And my very dear friend, Ev Ehrlich, who's been the intellectual leader of this effort for us. Ev and I, first, we go back a long way. It was a work release program when we were both up on Capitol Hill at the Congressional Budget Office. And then Ev and I, he came back in town, was the undersecretary over at the Commerce Department, and we had a chance to work then. And at the time, Ev was, when he was up on Capitol Hill, was instrumental with working on exactly these kinds of issues. So he's a long-standing intellect of deep reputation. So I'm grateful to you, Ev, for helping with this. I think we won't wait longer. What I'd like to do is to turn it now to Felix Roten, who is going to get us started, and I know he's got some comments, and I'll let him turn it to the rest of our commissioners. Felix?
Thank you. Does this work?
Yes.
I am very grateful for having been able to participate in this work here with Warren Rudman and all the other members of the commission on a subject which has fascinated me for probably 30 or 40 years, ever since I became a citizen of the United States and learned about American history. I started to look at what each one president after another had done in terms of public investment, because I don't believe you can have private wealth without public investment. And from the Louisiana Purchase to the Transcontinental Railroad to the TVA to the Eisenhower highway system, one after the other of these projects really has added to the national wealth. And in addition, Lincoln and Roosevelt invested in intellectual capital as well as physical capital. Lincoln with the land grant colleges and Roosevelt with the GI Bill. So it wasn't very complicated to see that over the years, public investment in this country was going down very rapidly because of the fact that the federal government was drawing back from it, leaving the states and local government with the job of keeping it going. And I became interested also when I was running the Municipal Assistance Corporation in New York, which we ran like kind of a small development bank to some extent. mostly to show that you can run one of these things and not lose money and finish up and having paid off your debts. And I thought it would be wonderful if we could create some kind of a structure in this country that would deal with shortages of infrastructure and act as sort of a catalyst between the federal government, state and local governments, and the private sector. And that is what we're trying to do here. I won't go into any numbers because none of these numbers are worth anything. You can read the report of the engineers, and they say there's a shortage of $1.6 trillion over 5 years to bring the infrastructure of this country to a decent condition. There is the current expenditure, which is about $50 to $60 billion. Right after 9/11, I had a meeting in New York with the controller of New York and about 12 or 14 managers of public employee pension funds who wanted to use their pension funds to help if we could do it in a fiduciary respectable way, and they added up to $280 billion. So money is not going to be the concern here if we can do this right. And if we can't do it right, we shouldn't do it. So this is really what prompted me to try to move this. I'm a European by birth, and so I go to countries which have extremely good infrastructure, which they finance with long-term debt with the European Investment Bank, and which is very good for their economy and very good for their standard of living. And I wish we could do something like that here. So I thank the fellow members of the commission. I thank the CSIS for taking on this project. John Hamry, who when I was ambassador to France used to visit me in his quality of Deputy Secretary of Defense. And now I will turn this over to Warren.
Felix, thank you. We thank John for giving us the ability to do this project and all the people who helped with it. We've had a great deal of help. There is one thing I want to say here in a formal way, so there's no misunderstanding because of the relationship between states and the federal government, and it's a very important statement so that everybody understands why there are a number of governors who agree with what we're doing. Governors always worry that Washington uses funding procedures to dictate federal priorities on local and state government leaders. I want to make it very clear that our goal is to improve efficiency and rationality in the infrastructure program. We're not interested in setting up a policy that in any way dictates the local needs. Local needs and state and local government coordination of those needs ought to be their responsibility. Federal government, however, can do a lot to prioritize on those goals, such as improving security at critical infrastructure facilities, particularly in this post-9/11 world, putting priority on multi-state projects. We want to create a new framework that establishes a transparent process that will aid in the developing of what are enormous needs to improve and replace aging national infrastructure. It has to be a partnership between the private sector, the federal government, state and local governments. Now, beyond that, I just make the observation that it doesn't take a rocket scientist or even a civil engineer, if you travel around this country, to understand that we are facing an enormous problem with aging facilities in some very key areas: schools, bridges, wastewater and drinking water facilities. Many of them are well below what would be a passing grade. There are health and safety issues involved. And it is our view that there ought to be a way to look at this at the national level and to find a financing mechanism that will not add to the current deficit, because that is obviously not acceptable and politically unacceptable. The report that we're releasing today lays some options out for how this can be done. I think it's politically doable, but it will take a good deal of discussion. We don't assert that our solution is the only solution. It's one of a variety of ways you might approach it, but we think it's sound for a number of reasons, And we hope that starting today, there will be a discussion in the appropriate places about how to do this. There is no question the longer we wait to act on this, the more problems we're going to have. It's a lot like the entitlement issue that the federal government faces. There's an explosion point, and when that happens, fixing it becomes extraordinarily difficult. This is precisely true with the replacement of aging infrastructure. The longer you wait, the higher the cost, both financially and in human cost. We think the private sector has a major role to play. We think the federal government has a major role to play. And, of course, the state and local governments where much of the infrastructure needs replacing. Felix mentioned the figure. It is obviously a substantial figure, whether it's $1.2 million or $1.5 trillion. I'm not sure what the number is, but we do know that over the next 10 or 15 years, unless substantial investments are made in this infrastructure, we will have some rather tragic outcomes in places where all of a sudden there is enormous human and economic displacement because infrastructure that's needed fails. So we are delighted that you came here this morning, and I'm glad to welcome my former colleague, Chris Dodd. Come up and take a seat, Chris. All right, Felix. And I think I'll, Felix, pass it back to you as the chairman, and you can go on down and introduce people, and we'll be happy to take your questions.
Well, John Castellani.
Thank you. I'm John Castellani. I'm president of the Business Roundtable, and on behalf of the 165 chief executive officers who make up the Business Roundtable, I was delighted to be part of this commission. This gets to one of the fundamental issues about our ability to be able to compete and win in a global environment. It does us no good as business if we can efficiently make our products or our services, but they are stuck at the loading docks, or they are stuck at the ports, or stuck at the airports, or we do not have the telecommunications infrastructure that we need to be able to compete and do business in this very fast-paced and very quickly changing global environment. Additionally, some of the other infrastructure that isn't as obvious from a business connection is also critically important. We in this country and the country's businesses depend on scientists, mathematicians, engineers, and technologists who need to be trained at the K-12 level as well as the university level and be prepared to go to university to study these disciplines. And if they're doing so in school systems and in school buildings that cannot provide the kind of environment where they can then prosper in the college and the university level, we will not be able to compete in the future. At the same time, everyone on this commission has recognized that the era of big government is over, and that we very much do need to bring our own fiscal house into order, but we also at the same time need to be creative about how we deal with the backbone of the United States that is going to cause us, is already causing us, to be unable to compete with nations who invest very heavily in infrastructure. Smart investment, creative investment is something that the nation needs to make as a critical priority. I was delighted to participate with my fellow commissioners, and we look forward to raising the awareness of this issue and getting this implemented so that we can have the kind of vibrant and growing economy that creates jobs in the future. So thank you.
Thank you very much, John. We have the good fortune of having four members of the Senate on our commission, two former members and two sitting members. Warren Rudman and Bob Carey are the former members, and Chris Dodd and Chuck Hagel are the sitting members. And Chris is with us today, and so I'll turn the podium over to him.
Well, thanks very much, Felix, and my apologies for being a few minutes late, but let me first of all commend those of you who have been involved in this very directly from the outset. This is a tremendous effort, and I'm pleased to be a part of it. I'm sorry, I just ran into Chuck Hagel, by the way, who regrets he couldn't be up here with us today, but wanted to express his continued support for this effort. Politics is always about choices. I mean, they're not, most times choices aren't that difficult to make. Other times they're harder. But this is really about choices we need to make at the outset of the 21st century. There's never been a time in American history, for those of you good students of it will confirm this, where our economic growth and prosperity have been somehow delinked from our investment in the infrastructures of our country. Go back to the earliest days of the Republic. some of the very first things we did as a nation were to invest in basic infrastructure. And as a result of those investments, we began to grow and prosper. Certainly throughout the 20th century, that was very, very clear. It's deeply troubling to many of us here, regardless of party or ideology, that we're not making the kinds of intelligent investments in the physical infrastructure of our nation that will be necessary for us to succeed, prosper, and grow in the 21st century. I'm sure others have already heard the litany of things that need tremendous investment, where one out of every three of our road systems are falling apart, one of every three of our bridges are collapsing in the country and outdated, obsolete. 54,000 drinking water systems are deep, deep trouble. We have sewage, wastewater pouring into our bodies of important water systems throughout the country that are in desperate need for wastewater treatment facilities. Schools are really in public schools, need tremendous investment and help. You can go down the long list of these basic infrastructure needs that are going unattended to. And if we fail to make those kind of investments, come up with a good structure and a system on how to do that, then I really do worry about the success this country can have in the 21st century. This is a miracle that's happened because people have made tough choices over the years, and it's incumbent upon all of us who care about the country to do so again at this time in our history. I'm hopeful that we can get the kind of support we need here to come up with some creative ideas of financing so that we can start to do the things necessary. There have been some ideas that we put forward on the table, some bonding ideas that we've already adopted, small amounts. Warren Rudman did a terrific job, in my view, 4 years ago with outlining a study done by the Council on Foreign Relations that we've tried, by the way, over the last 4 years to have included as part of the budget process and have failed. I might point out on narrow votes, but nonetheless have made the effort to try and get the Congress to pay more attention to some of these issues. I authored some legislation to create some sort of a system for our massive transportation needs in the country. We've asked others to join with us in support of that effort. So I want to commend again the Center for Strategic and International Studies for really putting this together. The fact that all of you have turned out today is very heartwarming. I half expected to walk into the room and see four or five or six people show up. Infrastructure doesn't exactly light up the lights in a room. But the fact that you're out here today indicates that you think this is important. And certainly those of us who have joined this particular effort believe so as well. So I look forward to working with this distinguished group of people. Felix Rowetten has been talking about this issue, bending my ear for decades about the need for infrastructure in our country.
Follow the trail of sleeping people.
That's right, yeah. And Bernie Schwartz, I have great, great respect for, who's done so much work in this. And John, it's good to see you and the Business Roundtable involved in this. And, of course, to be associated with Warren Rudman and Bob Kerry and Chuck Hagel is always a pleasure. Just a tremendous public servants, people who care an awful lot about the country. So my hope is we can get something done. I'm glad to be a part of this effort today.
Chris, now I'd like to have Bernard, as a great entrepreneur, private sector person, businessman, give us his perspective here.
Yes, thank you. I think this effort is very, very important because we have in this country a malfunctioning budget system that just doesn't work. It doesn't work on lots of levels, but one of the areas it doesn't work on is to be able to separate the operating budget from a capital budget. In business, we have a capital budget, which is self-financing. And is spread over many years, usually the years of the benefit of the project involved. What Felix has come up with is a mechanism that with the utilization of perhaps government guarantees, but a partnership between private sector and local governments, will be able to construct the kinds of capital investments that we need in this country, but will be paid for as the project produces benefit to society. And therefore, it is almost like a self-financing function. It is really a simple win-win situation if we can get the political traction to get it politically acceptable. The former speakers have said that capital investment in this country is something that people just run away from because it's too hard to understand. Everybody understands the need, but they don't understand how they go about it. And usually governors who have the incapacity, they don't have the capacity to solve their problem, are left floundering. The government, the federal government, has to be not only a partner but a significant leader in this effort. And to do so without adding to the current operating deficit is something that seems like a very simple thing for us to want to do. So I'm very pleased to be part of this project and gratified by the response that we have here today.
Thank you. And I think our last speaker is Ev Ehrlich, our executive director.
Let me defer to the questions and move things along.
All right.
Ladies and gentlemen, why don't you address your questions directly to the participants? I think that's easy for them. If you could use the microphone, that would be best because we are trying to record the. Go ahead.
Hello, I'm a Democrat from Pennsylvania, and I just wanted to say something to the two standing members of the Senate.
That's me, I guess.
not the sitters.
Does he count for two, does he?
So glad I walked in.
I'm extremely concerned about infrastructure, and so it's high time that something happened. But the one thing that I'm most concerned about, I'm sorry to say, is that the advice should not be coming from Mr. Rohatyn, because really, given the Lazare Frères Bank and their history as being part of what the financial world calls a Synarchist International, this man cannot be trusted.
Well, we appreciate your comment. And, we know Mr. Rohatyn very well. You've made your statement, and we appreciate it, and I don't want you to monopolize the microphone.
All right, one more thing.
I think you've had your time at the microphone. You've made your comment. We all know Mr. Rohatyn is extraordinary public service to America.
But his way friend Peter Fever even said that this is neo-feudalism.
This is
really
not a forum for that kind of debate. I'd like you to take your seat. Okay? Thank you very much.
Felix, you got any more friends in the room?
Yeah, right. All right, let's go. Some more questions, or questions instead of speeches.
Hey, yes. David, how are you?
Hello, David.
Just a question, just the process and how you reconcile this. You have transportation bills that go through, and yet you have this massive earmarking that occurs. That probably isn't the most efficient utilization of resources on infrastructure. Maybe important projects, but there has to be some greater kind of competitive process or some process to review these so that they do make sense. And how does that square with what you're recommending in the report?
Well, I would only tell you, David, that, you know, I think this gives people a lot of political cover for what they're now doing. They could always point to a structure which we suggest as the one that will prioritize on a nonpartisan basis how this money ought to be spent. I mean, the amount of earmarking is really disgraceful, not only for the amount, but for how it is spent. So we think this ought to help that. At least that's my view. Chris?
Well, in fact, when I leave here, I'll go back. I'll be managing on the floor of the Senate this reform bill that includes earmark legislation. And one of the suggestions has been, of course, to require that people have to identify their earmarks, identify themselves being the authors of various earmarks, to prohibit what's the policy in the past where an earmark will be put into a conference report, neither in the House nor the Senate bills, and come back. And there's no way of really getting it out without destroying the entire piece of legislation. We'll now allow for that to be taken out of the bill unilaterally without having to necessarily undermine the entire piece of legislation to which it's attached. Let me say this also. I think the absence of us really doing something on a large scale that we need to be doing here in infrastructure has also invited the kind of earmark legislation. Members of Congress generally are pretty proud of their earmarks for the most part. They're there helping people. They usually put press releases out that they're going to do them. They put out a press release announcing they've achieved it, whether it's a water system, a sewage system, a school, whatever else. For the most part, these are pretty good projects on a local level. The problem is they're not regional. They're not national in scope. They're not connected to anything else. This is one of the suggestions that John and others have put together here, that we need to be focusing more on the regional, national needs of the nation. So in the absence of having national leadership, which talks about major infrastructure investments in the country, you're going to see a continuation of the earmark approach, because members of Congress are going to try and take care of their states, where there's very little today flexibility given local budgets to invest at the local level or state level, relying on a property tax, basically, to fund most of this stuff makes it very, very difficult. So I have my respect for my colleagues. I don't have the problem that others do with earmarks, per se, except for the fact that we've allowed too much of this to occur in the dark, without people knowing what's really going on, and in the absence of national ideas, big ideas, such as what's being proposed here today, to really provide for the kind of infrastructure investment we ought to have. Yeah.
Something recently came to my attention, a proposal that you had made at a conference that you sponsored along with a very influential man in the Republican Party, George Shultz. This was a conference at Middlebury College where the discussion was centered around privatizing U.S. military functions. And we actually have you on record in the transcript saying that...
Who's you you're talking about here?
The transcript for the presentation.
Am I me?
No.
Who are you addressing this
Who's
to?
Who's you?
I'm addressing this to Felix Rohatyn.
Okay. I'm just curious.
A proposal
that I thought I was with George Shultz somewhere.
We have you on the transcript saying that the only function which the U.S. military can carry out the private sector couldn't would be actually killing people. But in terms of running prisons and supplying military needs, that would all be more easily accomplished under private control. And we've seen this actually in the works under companies like Bechtel and Halliburton over the course of the last 5 years, actually 10 years, increasingly. And when I was looking back at the history, because I was unfamiliar with that proposal of precedents for this, I couldn't really find any recent precedents other than replacing the German Wehrmacht with the Waffen-SS. And I was wondering how you reconcile this proposal for privatizing the U.S. military with these infrastructure.
Yeah. I'd like to step in here because I actually was at that conference, and I was the Deputy Secretary of Defense. Let me talk with you when we get done about this issue. This is a session about America's critical infrastructure, not about the privatization of defense functions. So if it's all right with you, I'd like to keep it on the subject, and you and I will talk when we get done. All right? Thanks.
Of the infrastructure projects on long term, and not actual the federal government. From Lyndon LaRouche, actually. And I think Lyndon LaRouche has a better idea.
Yeah, I think we're all aware of Mr. LaRouche's presence in this room through his surrogates this morning. And let me simply tell you that you're entitled to your view. We have laid out in great detail why we think this commission works. And you're free to disagree, and you're free to express it to congressmen and senators as you wish. But, we have laid out a proposal here. It's a serious proposal. Those who wish to disagree with it are free to. Could we have another question,
please?
Can I just
make a comment about it? I think somebody ought to say something about the fact that the fact is what we're just suggesting here is that there's a great need. And the politics, the political structure, the political will of this country has not been able to meet that need. And so there's a failure in our society with respect to how to build up your investment in infrastructure that's so important not only for this century, this year, but for the period of our children come. The idea here is to set an environment here that depoliticizes the project. This is a nonpartisan effort, clearly nonpartisan. It is not federal any more than the state or local. It is a mechanism by which you can combine the power of the federal government from the point of view of allowing its credit to be used, an agency that will be looking at the various demands across the country and choosing those that are most valuable to society in terms of productivity, in terms of creating jobs, in terms of improving our standard of living, and an oversight to make sure that there is not an imbalance of interests that work out in the future. So this is not an agency that's going to be run by bankers or by big business or by municipal governments or by state governments or the federal government or bureaucrats. It is a mechanism to take the best in the country, put them into a nonpartisan environment so that we can get something moving. We can talk this thing to death, as we have talked about many of these projects to death. That would be a sad thing.
Somebody in the back of the room there?
Yeah.
Standing up.
Let me put the question from Lyndon LaRouche a different way. What about the model of Franklin Roosevelt's presidency, which gave us most of the durable infrastructure that we have in this country now, which was based on the method of which was large public credits issued from the federal government, large public spending, not private investments in order to get the Reconstruction Finance Corporation going and build the TVA, but large public credits. Today we know in the order of trillions of dollars. Is that what you're proposing?
By the way, we're all with LaRouche, sir.
No, we have a lot of new financing mechanisms since the days of the New Deal. And Roosevelt did marvelous things because he had nothing, no alternatives with respect to financing these projects. We do. We have the private sector. We have state and local governments. We have pension funds. We can create special purpose bonds. Some of it may come directly from the budget, but that is the question we can only look at when we know what projects we're going to finance and how much it's going to cost and what kind of revenues they're going to produce. But we are far away from the days of the RFC where there was no other alternative to do this.
My name is Chris Miller. I'm from the state of Virginia. I'm doing a lot of work on infrastructure there. You set up the problem as failing infrastructure. You need to repair and to improve what's there. How do you prevent these financing mechanisms to be used predominantly for new infrastructure that, in fact, continues the lack of reinvestment, the lack of repair, the lack of emphasis on maintenance?
Ev, do you want to answer that?
Oh, I would speak to that. I think you identified an important problem. We're good at building things and not good at fixing them once they're built. And I think that that bias comes out of the structure of the trust funds, which go looking for things, new things to put on the ground. The structure we're proposing instead takes a look at major rehabilitation and repair and compares its rate of return to new construction and creates, for the first time in infrastructure policy, real neutrality between those. And I would also add to that neutrality between structural and non-structural alternatives. So if traffic management technology, peak use charges and the like are good and effective substitutes for building new roads, then let's by all means use them. And I think that's exactly the point of our thing.
Related point, and I, one of the things I was attracted to as well is we have a tendency to go back and constantly build the systems that are in use rather than also thinking about what systems we ought to be using. And so you end up today, obviously, with our, I don't care what city you go in, the congestion on our highways and so forth, and promote continued use, obviously, of the automobile. And here we find our rail systems, which we know could make a tremendous difference in relieving the pressures, the hazards of driving on our roads. We do very little investment based on usage. And so we need to get away from the usage concept and be thinking more in a visionary sense about what we ought to be doing. And one of the benefits of having neutrality in this politically is you can get away from some of the those arguments that tendency to favor the current usage.
Lloyd?
Hey, Lloyd.
I, too, want to congratulate this commission on facing an issue that has seemingly been intractable and long overdue for addressing in a meaningful way. But one aspect of it I'd just like you to comment on to determine whether or not you see a bias to it is in response to the comments that each of you have made, I'm sure you're aware that in recent years, the last two or three years, that one of the manners in which the need has been addressed has been foreign investors. To come in Indiana, the recent toll road where they invested $3.5 billion to do the toll roads and the Skyway in Illinois, and the Trans-Texas Corridor in Texas. Do you see any problem or bias with non-U.S. Investment coming into the U.S. to enable us to respond to this need?
Anybody want to comment on that?
Well, I think it's interesting. Chris is here. I believe the Greenway, which was started with completely with U.S. money, has now been sold to a foreign investor.
Australian. Cool. But that's a classic example of a project that created more demand for infrastructure. We have no resources to serve, right. So I'm not sure that's a great example.
Well, there's some people who write it would say it was very successful. At least it shortened the time. You know, Lloyd, just to get specifically to your question, I think the issue is very timely. We have probably more than $80 billion and 5.5 million jobs in the United States that are dependent on foreign investment in this country. But in fact, the other side of the issue is also true. We invest a lot more overseas than foreigners invest here. I think that the issue is to money is money, I guess, from our perspective, as long as it's consistent with our national policies that protect national security, then I think certainly it should be welcome, because some of the creativity here that this commission is suggesting comes from fair rates of returns from that investment, and we should encourage more of that than discourage it.
I'd only want to add specifically that there's a big difference between the Macquarie Group acting to take infrastructure projects private in the U.S. and the questions that were raised about ports and about CNOC and the like. There's a lot of space between those two issues.
Absolutely.
Well, actually, the reason I raised the question is less on the controversy surrounding security than the fact that there is no impact on the debt structure. From a company, and these last three happen to be Spanish companies that came in. They have taken the revenues from the toll stream, for example, in Indiana. They brought in $3.5 billion, fresh money. They're creating U.S. jobs. The only controversy I'm aware of is locally political, getting the political buy-in to, in effect, give up those toll roads, or, in effect, having a foreign investment. I'm just trying to see, from those of you who've been grappling with this, if you see that as a welcome opportunity, less than this, of this obscure side of security, as a new way to get fresh money that doesn't impact on the budget deficit. And I think, for one, that that's the latter reason, the increasing emphasis on the budget deficit, that you'd have fewer people investing in infrastructure. And because, for all the reasons you mentioned, it is a boring subject. When people are looking on returns, it's hard to see the sewage treatment plants, et cetera, et cetera. But that's the reason I raised the question. Less on that.
Well, you know, I would just say, Lloyd, that, you know, from my point of view, if we truly believe in globalization, and we have to, if you look at the amount of American investment overseas, then with security concerns in mind, and that's always in mind, certainly there is nothing in our proposal that would not encourage that from happening. I mean, the money ought to flow where it ought to flow in terms of the kind of investment, whether it be in Indiana or in Maine or in New Hampshire, whatever. If a foreign company wants to make a major investment infrastructure, we ought to encourage it, not discourage it, because the fact is that even if you try to discourage it, with what's going on globally now, there is no way to discourage it, even for those who might wish to.
Just one point I want to make. I don't disagree with that point. Obviously, in a global economy, we must depend upon a foreign investment to come in. But my hope would be, as well as we look at these things, what I find troubling in a way is that we're finding fewer and fewer domestic operators who are willing to step up and do the kind of work. And we ought to be looking at economic models that encourage the growth of industries at home that could do this work. And I don't think we do enough of that, Lloyd. So that's the other side of the same coin, in a sense. Again, I have no problems at all in certain areas with the foreign investment coming in. I'm glad you distinguished here where there are some national security implications. And this week, in fact, we'll be marking up a bill in the Banking Committee dealing with the CFIUS issue in the Dubai ports, which has been so controversial. My hope is we'll do it intelligently and thoughtfully, not shut this all down, but have a system that allows us to legitimately examine national security questions. But my hope as well that we'll be talking about economic models here that can encourage. It was distressing to me to find out that you have very few people in this country even think about investing in some of these issues at all. And we ought to be talking about how we can do that, as well as having an open-door policy when it comes to foreign investment.
I do thank you for your service in this very critical area. We're talking about a lot of money and a lot of competing priorities in all of this. How do you, or would you speak to the governance that you propose, and what are the checks and balances? What is the transparency of the process? That's a good step towards getting customers to do.
I think Ev can describe the...
Yeah.
Well, all right. Any of us could. I think that we need to create an entity that can appraise projects using consistent techniques, consistent parameters, that in that sense looks like some of the functions that you see in the World Bank or in a private investment house. It's capable of applying standard criteria to a broad range of infrastructure modes. I think that that process is potentially far more transparent than one we have now, which either relies on earmarking, on the political stewardship of individual projects through the nomination and appraisal process, or in writing formula grants to states that make selections in the murky waters of state legislatures. This would give us the opportunity to look at a broad range of projects across modes and to, in a visible way, set priorities among them with an expert body. I think that the entity that we're talking about within the federal government would resemble perhaps the Public Company Oversight Board or the Federal Reserve, in that it would be expert, it would be quasi-independent, but nonetheless have a board of directors that came at the cabinet level. Beyond that, I think we're speculating about the details for a direction that is right now the issue more than the specifics itself.
But the one thing it would have to be, to pick up on your point, it would have to be totally transparent. I mean, all of its dealings would have to be transparent. There would be no need for freedom of information on what it did, because it would have to be done very openly, or else it would lose confidence both of the people and of the political establishment.
And hopefully this agency would not only be part of the selection of the priority, but would continue to monitor to make sure there's accountability and oversight.
Yes, ma'am?
I'm with the American Society of Civil Engineers, and actually that was kind of a nice segue to my question, which is we do the infrastructure report card, which you cite in your report, and I'm wondering at what point do you see a role for the technical and engineering solution to match with the policy and the financing solution? Often the engineering comes after someone's already decided.
Yeah.
So I'm wondering where in that whole process does the technical side fit in?
I think it goes back to the remark we made earlier about creating neutrality, that right now the system has a hammer and it goes looking for a nail. That is, it wants to build, and it needs to, and that, I think, goes to your remark about presuming a solution and then finding the best engineering fit. I think that the engineering needs to be front-loaded. Whether or not building a new road is the best alternative to putting technology on an old road, to making it a smart highway, or to use some kind of congestion cost, or to build mass transit, or to build, in this case of the interstate, high-speed rail on a regional basis, needs to be evaluated on its own merits before we start looking at specific project proposals and before we set priorities. And that's what's missing in policy today. The hammer and nail issue, we have guns that are pointed in one direction, for example, in the highway program or in the Corps of Engineers or the Airport Trust Fund, and those guns don't turn around very flexibly, and it's what we're trying to accomplish here.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank you. We promised Senator Dodd we'd get him out of here. I know he's got votes, and John Castellani, we'll get him back up to the Hill so he can save CFIUS, I think. So let me just say again, the essence of public leadership now is this intimate partnership between the government and the governed, working on problems together. That's the purpose of this commission. It was trying to bring together the very people that needed to solve it, and it has to be solved with both constituencies side by side. I want to say thank you again to our chairs and to all of our commissioners. Thank you, Senator Dodd, for coming today.
Thank you.
Why don't you come and talk to me? If there's somebody here that you want to talk to, we can do that later.
Right.
But I did promise them they were going to leave at this hour. Thanks.
Thanks very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
No, not at all. Thank you.